This podcast is brought to you by Deepbridge Capital LLP. Deepbridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. Welcome to this Deepbridge Discovery podcast. My name's Andrew Aldridge. I'm partner and head of marketing at Deepbridge Capital. The aim of these podcasts is to bring to life what we do at Deepbridge Capital and the industry we work in. I'm delighted today to be joined by the founder and managing director of Intelligent Partnership and MICAP, Mr. Guy Tolhurst. Hi, Guy. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Deepbridge Discovery podcast.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, great to see you. Just first and foremost, a number of our listeners and our viewers will be aware of who MICAP and Intelligent Partnership are, but can you, just for those that maybe don't, just give us an overview of kind of your role and kind of Intelligent Partnership and MICAP?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So MICAP and Intelligent Partnership are sister companies, and they fall under the Indigate Group, which we formed back in 2015. And my role is I'm CEO of the Indigate Group, a very grandiose title for running three small businesses, which is what I do. In terms of the two businesses that we're talking about today, so MICAP, you know, has quickly established itself, as you're aware, as the sort of go-to platform for comparing tax advantage investments for advisors and paraplanners. We now got over 1,000 firms subscribing to use the platform, which is great. Sort of great validation for the work that the team have done there. And that team, they're maintaining thousands of data points and storing lots of investment literature on all the EIS, business relief, and VCT opportunities in the market. So our users, they can access all of that. They can research and compare the whole market on our online platform.
You've also got some new features as well on MICAP as well. You're kind of going beyond just reporting and things. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just cover off very quickly what Intelligent Partnership does, and then dive into some of the new features. So Intelligent Partnership, for all intents and purposes, is a media and events business, and we're focused on providing education and insights on investments and finance that benefit UK businesses, because that's what I'm passionate about. And as a business, we're really passionate about small businesses. So what we want to do is educate advisors about investing in and supporting UK businesses using EIS, VCT, and business relief as mechanisms to do that. But we also want to educate businesses about their opportunities to secure capital to scale. And that could be debt or it could be equity. To help them, you know, realize their growth ambitions, roll out skills, recruit new talent, and really kind of help the UK with its economic recovery and leveling up agenda.
Absolutely, and supporting those growth businesses. So we reference kind of MICAP services and things. Can you just kind of go into some of the newer features and things that that advisors can get from using the MICAP platform?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, MICAP started its life as a sort of go compare without all the singing, you know, go on there, have a look at what was available in the market, compare them across 75 data points.
And you've not got any meerkats either, I take it.
No meerkats, no gimmicks. And how it's evolved is effectively we're an advisor first platform. So really what we wanted to do was make it more efficient for advisors to write this business. So save them time, save them money, and make it easier for them to write this business, as well as protecting people that are writing business potentially for the first time or writing a lot of this business. So the services that have evolved out of that, focusing on sort of making it easier and quicker, is the ability to quickly go on there, apply some filters, and get the market down from, say, 150 offers down to 15. So immediately, whole of market view, and then make it more manageable. They can then do some comparisons, so a side-by-side comparison, which they can print out with their name on, client's name on. And that's the sort of the first real thing in terms of protecting themselves. So we advocate, and a lot of our clients now require a comparison on every client file. Yep. And that's really important if you're looking sort of 5 years ahead of who might be, you know, looking at the client files. We also then have a portfolio builder tool, so they can look under the bonnet and see what's it going to look and feel like for their clients if they're diversifying across different strategies in terms of the sector allocation, the stages of company, blended charges, blended returns. So previously, you imagine if all you had to work off was an IM and the investment provider literature, and now what you can do is actually you can take all the pertinent data points and start slicing and dicing those into different scenarios. It's really making things much closer to the tools that advisors have available in the mainstream market. So that's how it evolved. And then that's all supported by the reviews that we do on the investments and managers. Some of our newer services around an audit trail tool. So we track every single click that a user does on MyCap. And, yep. and by doing that, they can build up an audit trail for them as an advisor or a power planner of all the research they've ever done on tax advantage investments. But they can then allocate that to specific clients. So again, protecting their advice business, they can put that on the file. Another new service that we launched, and new, it's been going a couple of years now, is our panel support services.
Yep.
So we now have 43 panel clients. So these are large Swiss banks and large UK national wealth managers that use MyCap to support them in putting their panels together. And effectively, they leverage MyCap's data to construct their panels, and we screen the market on a quarterly basis for them against their criteria. And we're about to launch a new service, but our kind of most recent service after panel was our client reporting service. And any advisor that's ever written a volume of tax advantaged business will say, you know, what a sort of dog's dinner it is trying to collect all of the data and the performance on all of the underlying investment. Yep. So we came at this slightly differently, trying to work with the fund managers, and effectively we developed a cross-market white labeled client reporting solution where we would go and collect all of the different data from all the different fund managers and put that into one report. So they could share that with their clients on a quarterly basis and see performance of all of their underlying investments, the available tax advantage, where the money had been deployed, and multiple of money returned, and those sorts of things. And sometimes that's the first time a client has actually seen any performance, let alone side-by-side performance across their whole portfolio. So yeah, so that's been a big growth area. We're now reporting on over 2,000 investors.
I was going to say, I think, I was recently on one of these podcasts reminiscing with Ian Warwick, our managing partner, about kind of when we first started in the IS space ourselves at DeepBridge, and kind of the shock of the lack of transparency in the market, kind of, again, pre-investment and post-investment.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of, I guess you kind of followed that journey, and you know, thankfully the market is a lot better, largely thanks to MyCap and other review agencies, etc. But
yeah,
that must be quite pleasing for you to have seen that kind of that growth in transparency and giving kind of more access and more information to people to make informed choices.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it's done is it's helped advisors' confidence in this area, but not Absolutely. Also the advisors. It's helped compliance firms, so service Yep. providers like the 360s and the Simply Biz, or if you're a national Yep. on a network, Yep. there's more confidence in the sort of business assurance teams there
Yep.
that actually this isn't the Wild West, that there is documentation available, that they can build an audit trail of their research, that there are independent reviews available. So Yep. what you're seeing is you're seeing more advisors writing business in this area, so, you know, for the first time, and Absolutely. More confident in writing this business, and also more confident to diversify.
Yep.
And I think that that's probably been the biggest change. Yep. Is the ability to be able to diversify with rationale.
Yep.
Rather than diversify just for the sake of it.
Not just finger in the air stuff, but actual genuine kind of information behind it.
Yeah.
And again, from our perspective, I think one of the things that I like looking at on MyCap particularly is fund performance, and you can compare funds and over times, etc. Thankfully, we're generally in the top quartile of that. So yeah, I can say that publicly now. But I think that kind of transparency and being able to see actually what's going on in the market and under the bonnet is hugely beneficial to the market. I guess kind of talking about that, since you formed both organisations, you must have seen some massive changes. We've had a patient capital review and various things in that time. Can you just talk around some of that evolution that you've witnessed in the sector?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, you nod to the patient capital review, and I think that that's absolutely right. You know, in terms of there being a genuine risk to capital, I think that the fund managers' strategies and the companies that are receiving the investment is exactly where these reliefs were intended to be. So I think that that is benefiting the right businesses, and you know, the asset-backed strategies of the past, you know, have gone quite rightly. So I think the tax reliefs are centered exactly where they should be, and what we can now start to do is really measure the impact of these investments. And looking ahead to, you know, this, you know, the sunset clause, which isn't too far away now, in, you know, 2025, it's really important to start considering the, you know, the impact on job creation, tax take, and all those sorts of things. In terms of how the sort of tax efficient investment market has evolved, I think that you've seen a lot of new entrants, you know, not as many in VCT. Understandably, you know, Pembroke was probably the noticeable new VCT that came into the market, and obviously Octopus just launched their Future Generations VCT. So some developments and evolution there in the VCT market. A lot of new EIS offers, potentially too many. in my view, and making it a little bit harder for advisors and sort of creating this peloton, really.
Yeah, is it also that maybe they're all kind of fighting over the same bits of business as well, and therefore going to you know, struggle?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, you want advisors and clients' experience of investing in EIS for the first time to be, you know, a positive one. And businesses are going to fail, and loss relief on EIS, you know, helps there, and obviously the tax relief on the way in. But I think that I'm fully supportive of new entrants, but I think that some have just sort of pivoted quickly into, okay, well, we're in this space, we're in the VC space, these companies qualify for EIS, let's now throw our product into the advice market. So I think that that's interesting. I think another area is, you know, ESG has been, you know, very, very prevalent, and quite a lot of sort of greenwashing as well in the mainstream market, but it is starting to filter down into, you know, tax efficient markets as well, and some real focus on sort of innovation in there. We've seen a lot of improvements as well around governance, particularly on business relief strategies, after there was sort of a notable failure within that market. So I'd say an overall improvement in terms of independent governance, corporate governance more widely, some good innovation as well, and EIS strategies targeting some particularly interesting sectors like life sciences and stuff that you obviously invest in.
Absolutely. And I think, I think the key thing for us over that period has been that kind of increase in transparency. You know, it's much easier now to see what companies are investing in, first and foremost, and also kind of how they're doing that and what they're doing under the bonnet, if you like. So, great. So I guess kind of if you're talking to advisors, what would be your kind of one bit of advice you'd give to an advisor looking at the tax efficient space for the first time?
So often the first bit of business is the riskiest bit of business, because, you know, it might be for a new client, it might be for a high net worth client who you, you know, haven't previously considered these sorts of investment for. And generally the one bit of business writer or the occasional business writer can create a risk, because focused on that. And it can sometimes make PI insurers nervous or compliance firms nervous. So all I would say is, try and future-proof the work that you're doing as much as you possibly can. So think ahead to 5 years' time, 10 years' time, when you might be wanting to sell your advice business, and imagine what somebody coming in and saying, okay, let's have a look at the quantum of high-risk business that you've written. Let's have a look at some of those client files. What might they expect to see in 3, 5, 10 years' time?
Yeah.
And if what you're doing currently in the mainstream market, and then think, is that sufficient for the tax advantage market? And all we would say is that with what's available in the market now, and, you know, nod to the tools that we have available in MICAP there in terms of the illustrations and the timelines and the highlights and considerations in our reviews, there's no reason that you wouldn't have a very detailed suitability report. There's no reason that you wouldn't have a comparison on file if you're making one recommendation to show that you've at least compared it. There's no reason you shouldn't have a personalized research document. So all I'd focus on, what might some of the expectations be if they were valuing your business and coming in 3, 5 years' time. So that would be my kind of bit of advice.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely personal. I think when several years ago, and since might have changed, but I remember speaking to Issa, the director general there at the time, who obviously we both know. And Mark was saying at the time that actually the stats for amount number of complaints and the percentage of complaints about EIS and VCT business was extremely low in the market, and that was partly because so much soft facts, so much was put into suitability reports to make sure that they were heavyweight, etc. And I guess as EIS, VCT, etc., become more commonly used, I hate to use the word mainstream, but more commonly used by advisors, I guess it's about making sure that those standards don't slip as they become more confident. And I guess your tools kind of help them and empower them to do that.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, in reference to that mainstream, it's often thrown around. I think that what's happening is it's becoming more mainstream as part of a financial planning proposition.
Absolutely.
Even though the investments themselves, you know, aren't necessarily considered mainstream because of, you know, the risks that are potentially associated with them and appropriateness and suitability of those investments. So I think that advisors quite rightly are looking at these sorts of investments. It's great to see that the complaints, you know, on them, you know, are low. Unfortunately, when there is one and there's a noticeable thing, it's in the financial trade press. But if you look at it in the context of numbers, I remember one particular sort of high profile one. I would imagine it would be low. And this is where the compliance functions, you know, are doing their job. And compliance used to be in the basement. And it's now in the boardroom, and you know, quite rightly so,
as it should be. Absolutely.
Excellent.
And so I guess we kind of talked to kind of looking back. I mean, are there any changes that you'd like to see to the EIS or VCT market or tax efficient in general? Any kind of changes to the markets or government kind of thinking or anything like that you'd like to see going forward?
Well, there were some campaigns in and around the sort of lockdown and things like that about increasing tax reliefs and things like that, but my personal view is I wouldn't tinker with the tax reliefs at all. I think that they work, they're attractive enough for investors to encourage business investment into, you know, businesses that may not have been able to secure finance in other areas. I think really what needs to be done, and this is effectively an industry stakeholder wide initiative, is much more work needs to be done on the impact of these schemes. And the data exists. So HMRC will know exactly which companies have benefited from EIS. Yep. Okay. And if you look at Treasury, HMRC, the data that companies like ourselves have on, you know, EIS fund performance and where the money's been invested, companies like Beauhurst have in terms of capital that's been invested, there's a sufficient enough data set here to measure the impact on of EIS on job creation, on tax that's been tax take and all those sorts of things. And I think that as we look towards the sunset clause, I'm certainly passionate about getting more impact stories out there, not just case studies, but data supported by case studies and, you know, entrepreneurs telling that story that, you know, if it wasn't for these reliefs, you know, we wouldn't have been able to start the business or we wouldn't have been able to grow the business.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, you know, kind of some of the interesting sectors and that we invest in life sciences. And, you know, on that very point, I was talking to the CEO of one of our companies, which is a cancer diagnostic tool. And we were talking about the commercial pressures and struggles, or not struggles, but challenges during the COVID period when they've not been able to go in and roll things out and do training and in a clinical environment. But as he said to me, in, you know, 2 weeks prior to I'd seen him, there'd been three ladies in one of the NHS they work with who had both been screened and diagnosed with cancer and could go down the treatment path that wouldn't have been without that device. I mean, it's those kind of impacts as well.
Absolutely.
Not just the jobs, the HMRC side. You know, those are three lives saved because of what this investment's done. So,
And so I think that, you know, with the British Business Bank, you've got an organization there, and I think it's just about, you know, as I say, cross industry stakeholders, British Business Bank, you know, EIS Association, AIC, you know, potentially BVCA, Beauhurst, Entrepreneurs Network, getting together and saying, you know, right, what story, you know, can we tell here? And the other thing I would say in terms of from the sector, as I think we're seeing much better corporate governance in, you know, business relief strategies. I do think, and I know this may make me a little bit unpopular, but I do think that there's some arrogance creeping in the VCT market.
Sure.
We've seen record fundraising this year. So I think that there needs to be more work done in terms of what they're giving back. So giving back to the advisors and the clients that have supported their businesses and invested within, and also the information that they're sharing in terms of the impact of the businesses that they've invested in and supported and things like that. And I think that, you know, I don't know profitability and balance sheets of, you know, running a VCT manager, but I just know that in some of our interactions with some of the VCT managers, they aren't as forthcoming as I would anticipate them being, bearing in mind that, you know, it's effectively the advisors and the investors that have built their businesses.
Yeah. And are the ones ultimately taking the risk as well.
You know, sort of paying it forward and paying it back.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think, like I said, I think it's the investors ultimately taking the risk. You know, it's you know, as much as you know, we stick our reputation on the line, etc., and you know, we want, you know, we're incentivized to make sure our companies perform, etc., as an EIS manager. You know, ultimately, it's the investor taking the risk. You know, and that's, I think, none of us as managers should ever lose sight of that. You know, it's not us taking the risk with our hard earned cash, if you like.
Yeah.
Kind of away from kind of that kind of topic. I mean, certainly over the last few years, I mean, you've been a massive advocate and a voice kind of talking about mental health, particularly in the workplace and in general. Can you just tell us a little bit about that and kind of what you've been doing and kind of your ethos, if you like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, sort of start by saying I'm not a mental health professional. No. You know, what I know around mental health is based on my lived experience, mm-hmm. and experiences that other people have shared with me. My particular area of interest, based on my own experiences, you know, mental health of founders and leadership teams, and, you know, the emotional toll it takes on individuals running a small business. And this was something that I was going on my own personal journey with, and experiencing periods of poor mental health, which were impacted by a life event, and some were impacted through, you know, running my small business. And so I started to talk to other people. I was in the middle of writing a book where we were showcasing stories of entrepreneurs that had grown their business. And as we were doing these interviews, lots of other entrepreneurs were starting to talk about the impact that growing a business had had on them personally, emotionally, mentally. So we took that as a lens and we started looking at the emotional capital of scaling and growing a business. And what we discovered was actually that investment wasn't always a force for good.
Yep.
And that actually taking on other people's money could actually exacerbate any
big significant pressure. Absolutely.
For some, it was the cause of issues that they were having, and for others it was a contributor. So we started looking at that, and what we wanted to do and, you know, engage with the investment industry was how could we balance people and profit in a more sustainable way. And fortunately, the VC industry responded really, really well. We launched an initiative called Mindful Investor, and we set out a framework which was called CHECK, which was around communication, health, equality, connections, and knowledge, which we saw were the sort of five pillars of mindful investment. And obviously health was in there as one of our key areas of focus. We did a successful launch event. We had over 100 VCs attend in London. But unfortunately, when COVID hit, I had to take a very hard, long look at the business and say, you know, what areas did we need to focus on as we were going to be working at reduced capacity and significantly reduced revenues. And unfortunately, I had to shelve Mindful Investor, but it's all there. There's still
ready
a lot of interest
back.
From the, and it's ready to come back at the appropriate time.
No, but I think that is massively important. Yeah, one of our recent podcasts that we've spoken to one of the CEOs of one of our investee companies, who we've invested in from seed stage right through to now kind of £1 million plus revenue and overseas sites and all this kind of stuff. And he was quite honest and open about his challenges, with kind of mental health and things during that period, and how he's kind of come out the other side and things. But it is the same, and you're quite right. It's the pressure of putting money on somebody else's money on your shoulders. Is huge. And
managing money and leading people. can become a very lonely experience.
Absolutely.
If you imagine the pincer, or leadership team in the middle of that hourglass. It takes its toll on a lot of people.
And it's something we're very conscious of when we're investing with people. And I think it comes back to when we often talk that at the due diligence stage of investing companies, we can do all the legal due diligence, the financial due diligence, but it's the people due diligence as well. And it's not just about, do we like them? Do we respect them? Do we get on with them? But it's also, have they got the skills to cope with what they're doing, etc.? And are they open? And will they tell us if they've got problems? And that includes personal as well as kind of business things. And I think that's hugely important. That, again, that communication word that you keep referring to is massively important there, to make sure that people aren't suffering in silence.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're a successful entrepreneur with running various businesses and things, and kind of, what are your kind of key takeaways or key themes or kind of keen learnings that you've had about what makes either a good leader or a good company to work in and with, etc.? What's kind of your takeaways over that experience?
So I think one of the most powerful things for a leader or an entrepreneur is vulnerability.
Yep.
And this was something that I never would have considered until I sort of went on my own journey about, being vulnerable and those sorts of things. And I think as soon as you can, take yourself off a pedestal for the benefit of your team, for the benefit of your customers, for the benefit of your stakeholders, and engage at more of a human level and be sort of honest with people about your qualities as a leader, your failings as a leader, your blind spots and things like that, you will create a much stronger support network around you. And on that same vein is about asking for help. So being honest, vulnerable with yourself about where your gaps are, and asking for help. And I think mentoring is a hugely powerful tool there. I'm starting to learn quite a bit about reverse mentoring as well at the moment. Okay. So not just, I was very lucky to be mentored by a fantastic gentleman called Mike Harris, who was the founder of Egg and First Direct. He I've put him up on a pedestal because he's a god to me in the kind of entrepreneurial world. But actually, to stay relevant as a leader, you need to do that reverse mentoring. So I'm trying to understand actually younger generations, what do they care about? What are they interested? What sort of businesses do they want to work for? And really focusing in on that future generations. And a lot of inspirational leaders and stuff that I follow and aspire to emulate are focused in on that reverse mentoring, where effectively you're taking the input and feedback and soundings from younger generations to make yourself more relevant and your business more appealing to younger generations.
Yeah, I think that's,
which takes a lot of vulnerability and honesty. If you
it
take,
does.
You
I think know, I think honesty is the key thing.
CEO of Lloyds Bank or something, it's kind of like, actually we've got a steering committee over here of people who are all older and wiser than me, but actually should we have a steering committee over here of people who are younger but more in tune with the needs of the next generations?
And we'll have different skill sets, and you'll have great leaders in there and things as well. And I think one of the joys of what we do is we working with our investee companies, the entrepreneurs running those businesses, because you've got fabulous people from I'm sure some of them won't mind saying that some of them are grey-haired, some have no hair, but then you've got guys that we've got guys in their 20s who are starting great companies, and these
got
great
long hair and ponytails.
Not quite, but not just yet. Yeah, they're not based in Shoreditch, so excellent. So in these podcasts, we also like to give our viewers and our listeners just a bit of a flavor for the people we're talking to. So can you just give us a quick overview of kind of what you do away from work? I know you work stupid hours a lot of the time and things, but kind of what are your interests away from the desk?
I don't know life away from work.
It is your passion. It is your hobby. I know.
No, I mean, to be honest with you, so I thought about this question and it's changed for me. And I think that COVID has had a big impact on that. So, mm-hmm. you know, and children, of course, you know, and yeah, well, I like being outside and I like anything to do with water. So I'm passionate if I'm paddleboarding, I'm fishing, out on a boat, you know, those sorts of things. I also like hurtling down, you know, mountains on skis and various things like that. So anything that sort of adventure, travel, those sorts of things, you know, sign me up. But post-COVID, I have been focusing in a little bit closer to home. So potentially less adventure. I don't know if this is a sign of age or becoming a little bit more insular or protective.
I wasn't going to say
my
that.
Own protective of my own time. But you know, I used some downtime during lockdown and time with my children to learn carpentry.
Yep.
And it's amazing how impactful when your business world is in flux. And you're questioning yourself about, you know, your abilities because, you know, as an entrepreneur, one of the hardest things, you're constantly making bets, but you're making bets in more of like a certain world. You know your market, you know how things are going, and you make bets in a certain world. But when you come into an uncertain world, like we did with COVID, and you start making bets in an uncertain world, it multiplies the risk to almost an incalculable level, which entrepreneurs, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs I know really, really struggle with. So in order to get your validation for yourself as an entrepreneur, you need to kind of succeed in things and you need to complete things and you need to do things that you're proud of. And so I turned to carpentry. So I started building furniture in my home. So I built all of my children's bedroom furniture from scratch, buying sheets of birch ply and making it into interesting bunk beds and shelves and drawers and stuff. So I kind of started looking a little bit closer to home for interests like that, that could still give me some self-validation and make
give you that kind of self-confidence that you're doing the right things and making the right things.
And my kids are very, very proud. They couldn't understand at the time why everything was still, because I varnished everything as wood, why it was all wood, and they kept saying, am I going to paint it? I was like, no, that's the look.
I want people to know that I made it. Yeah. Exactly. And nothing's fallen apart yet, I take it. Yeah, that's good.
Nothing, no deaths. Nothing's fallen apart yet.
Excellent. Good. And kind of last question we ask all our guests on the Discovery podcast is you're invited to the Deepish dinner party. You've got three guests you can bring with you, excluding family and friends, because obviously we don't want to upset or offend anybody. But, you know, kind of from history or alive, kind of what three people would you, or which three people would you invite?
Well, thinking back to, I think I did go to a Deepbridge dinner party once with John Major, didn't I?
Indeed, yeah.
I did, absolutely.
So you can't have John Major on the list then.
he was a good guest, but if I can't have him. Okay, so, I mean, first on my list would always be David Attenborough. I think like he's an absolute hero of mine. He's kind of my happy voice. You know, I've had a very particularly stressful day. Watching a nature program, listening to David Attenborough, it's amazing the positive impact that has on my mental health. So I think just being in his presence would make me feel immediately calm. I also really, really like Brené Brown.
Okay.
Yeah. She's an inspirational leader. She majors on vulnerability, which obviously touches on the sort of things, and also around not feeling shame. Which, you know, as a human and an individual and a parent and an entrepreneur, you know, you can build up a lot of shame in yourself because you put yourself at, you know, set very, very high standards for yourself. So she's been very, very inspirational to me, and I enjoy listening to the things that she says. And I think the third one would probably be someone like Wim Hof.
Okay.
I've done ice baths, I do cold water swimming, cold showers and things like that. He's also hilarious and a real character. So I think that I think that what I've learned from him and others around the power of your own breath, and the fact I've, you know, learned in the last few years about how as humans we're all breathing wrong. And that we can actually fix a huge amount of our own, you know, mental and physical issues through breath. And also the fact that through cold water therapy and lots of things that Wim Hof gets involved in, very quickly and easily you can do things to, you know, improve your outlook, your day and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, bit of a weird match, mismatch. David Attenborough, Brené Brown and Wim Hof at my dinner party.
I have to say, I think we've done probably about a dozen podcasts so far. David Attenborough's come up a few times, but Brené Brown and Wim Hof have not come up so far. So that's good. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time, Guy. Really appreciate your time today. And I look forward to catching up with you soon.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Love talking to you. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Guy. Thank you for joining us. If you have any topics you'd like us to discuss in future DeepBridge Discovery podcasts, please email us at discovery@deepbridgecapital.com. This podcast was brought to you by DeepBridge Capital LLP. DeepBridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon.